Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Product Fundamentals Podcast, Episode 11. So what? Well, you've made it. This is the final episode of this season on the history of software development methodology. We've covered a lot of ground for a topic that seemed niche at the outset. The origins of software engineering, waterfall versus incremental and iterative development, the background of management by objectives and OKRs, the Agile Manifesto and its precursors, alphas, betas, and A-B testing, Agile at scale, and the maybe death of Agile, DevOps, and even the history of the office and of working from home. After all that, in this episode, I'll try to make sense of that history and synthesize it into a few conclusions. I opened this season with the question, why do we make software in the weird way that we do? I've gone through a bunch of mental models to answering that question while working on this project. Sometimes it's felt like technological determinism. Other times I've felt the temptation of narrative to ascribe the things I don't like to the influence of bad actors. But if we're being honest, I think that the reason we make software in the weird way that we do is mostly because of an evolving, generally workable, but often ungainly compromise between workers and managers as they both deal with rapidly evolving technology. The muddy agile consensus, as I labeled the dominant de facto methodology of the industry in the preamble episode, is a cobbling together of odds and ends that each worked in some context and then got universalized even as the underlying reality changed. Thus, we've ended up with accumulated bits from different eras and worldviews, and we've never really cleared the cache in order to see what still makes sense. Now, I'll be the first to admit that a conclusion of historical path dependency happened, and that's how we got to today, is not the most satisfying. But, to be fair, I did tell you up front that it was going to be a history podcast, and history almost always involves a bunch of path dependency and contingency. Beneath the obvious observation that the present was caused by the interaction of things in the past, though, are some observations or principles that I think can be useful to us as practitioners. I'll lay out four. First, continuous exponential technological improvement has been critical to keeping our business from ossifying. Or, put another way, Moore's Law is what keeps this fun. Without ongoing technological innovation and disruption, the forces of standardization, routinization, and cost reduction would make software into a much less rewarding and fulfilling industry to work in. Exponential growth is amazing, and we should appreciate it. Historically, computing has enjoyed exponential growth curves for the transistor count on a processor, the energy efficiency of processors, bytes of storage on a disk, and the affordability of internet connection bandwidth. Unfortunately, these exponential growth trends don't last forever. Dennard scaling for energy efficiency and Kreider's law for the cost of storage have already broken down. Whether Moore's law has already fallen or will soon fall has been a perennial topic for at least a decade, but it does have to end someday. Only Nielsen's law of internet bandwidth appears to be holding steady, and even that's a bit under its trend line in the last 2 years. To be clear, computing can and will continue to improve after these laws break down. Marginal sustaining innovations and occasional big breakthroughs will very likely still occur in a world without exponential improvement. Economies of scale and production learning curves will continue to yield benefits. Even though the continuous exponential drop in disk storage costs broke down around a decade ago, for example, storage is still much cheaper today per gigabyte than it was just a few years ago. But from the perspective of a software worker who wants to keep having a well-paying job while doing creative work, the end of exponentiation is concerning. Throughout this season, we've seen numerous attempts to standardize the process of making software, turning it into a routine job with one right way to work. That was the goal of the NATO conference in 1968, and was one of the motivations for Fred Brooks in the Mythical Man Month. It was the goal of the attempts at creating software factories in the 1970s, and it was the goal of the British and American standards that codified waterfall as the only way to make software for the government. This impulse to standardization generally failed because exponential growth in technical capabilities, in a competitive market, made a stable equilibrium impossible. Instead, we've lived in a rapid tick-tocking between complexity and abstraction in the methods and outputs of software development. It hasn't been rational or effective to lock down one right way to make software products, however much the bottom-line optimizing scientific management aficionados might have wanted to. If exponential growth in capabilities really does end, I expect that much of the fun, and the remuneration, of software will go with it. As long as there are streams of exponential growth, or if new frontiers of exponential improvement somehow open, those will be the areas to work on in order to have the best time. Second, neither technology nor market define a single way to work. As important as the underlying technologies have been in shaping how we work, they haven't been determinative of a single right way to do it. From the 1960s through at least the 1990s, there were thoughtful individuals, teams, and organizations working under a waterfall method, and there were thoughtful individuals, teams, and organizations practicing iterative and incremental development. These were very different ways of working, and while both evolved, they also each maintained their distinctive core ideas, which I'll touch on soon. Both waterfall and IID were used at the cutting edge in the 1960s. Both faced the bureaucratized corporate markets of the late 1970s and 1980s, and both had to deal with the consumerization of software in the 1990s. The existence of two very different methodologies, competing for decades, across multiple waves of technological change, says that neither the technology nor the market in which we make software leads definitively to one way to work. One way to work may be better or worse than others in many circumstances, but people can persistently choose different ways of working while facing the same environment. This is true of other areas of how we work beyond software methodology. Firms using OKRs and using other management systems have stably competed for decades. Firms have embraced or avoided work from home for decades. Neither technology level nor broader economic environment have forced the industry to follow just one way. This means that we should remain humble and open-minded in thinking about how we will work in changing conditions. There is probably more than one way to do it, and the fact that a model has flourished for decades does not necessarily mean that it is the optimal one for any single context, let alone for every context. So if technology and market are not determinative of how we build, what is? My claim is the third principle that I draw from this season. How we work is largely driven by ideas and values. I posit that core values and ideas about the world make a critical difference in shaping methodology. In the context of waterfall versus IID, the essential difference between the camps that motivated the choices was epistemological. That is to say, practitioners of each had very different senses of what was knowable. Waterfall was predicated on the idea that with enough planning, analysis, forethought, and documentation, incredibly complicated problems could be tamed and turned into manageable projects with clear timelines. If we're smart enough and we do enough homework first, we can build the right things. Iterative and incremental development is anchored in a fundamentally different worldview. The difference isn't just we organize our work into two-week chunks instead of bigger milestones. There's a deeper distinction at work. IID practitioners admitted and embraced the fact that they didn't know the right way to get to the destination at the start. We just don't quite know what's going to happen. Instead, they had to take smaller steps, try things, backtrack, and so on, until they eventually discovered the right solution. Peter Drucker's Management by Objectives is another fine example of the importance of ideas. Drucker fled Germany in 1933 and had his books burned by the Nazis. Then, when he writes The Practice of Management in 1954, he argues that businesses must simultaneously balance a plurality of goals, including those that are explicitly pro-social. He insists that companies organize their workers around broad objectives rather than specific orders. It's hard to miss the role of his core values in this theory. When Andy Grove reworked Management by Objectives to be increasingly quantified and stratified, he wasn't obviously advancing some truer way to run a business. Businesses were doing fine without the structure of quantified laddered OKRs. Grove was applying his aggressive temperament and analytical engineering brain to the problem of how to organize a business, and the modern notion of OKRs was the result. The values that practitioners bring to bear are determinative of how we work. In a big economy with lots of uncertainty, I think this should be freeing and exciting. There is not one obvious correct way to work. We can find other ways to do it that reflect what we value, and subject to the pressures of competitive markets, we can succeed in a variety of ways. That said, there's no denying that some ideas spread rapidly through the software business and become all but monolithic. This brings us to the final principle that I want to draw your attention to. Our business is prone to fads. We software people tend to pride ourselves on diversity and free thinking, but the reality is that we are subject to trend chasing, just like everyone else. Of course, some trends are entirely rational, especially those rooted in the emergence of new technologies. New technologies can open new markets or make new techniques possible, and it often makes sense to pile in on those. But then there are the cultural and intellectual trends that deserve more skepticism, because they often result in overreach and blowback. Seeing software as an engineering discipline that can be solved might have been the first trendy brainworm in our industry. In the context of big science, the space race, and software's roots in logic and mathematics, mapping software onto engineering was an understandable choice. Certainly, there are elements of software for which that mental model is a good fit. But that model also failed. We never found the one right way. And the pursuit of software as a solvable problem caused frustration and failure for many people and organizations for decades. Before software, scientific management was a meme that moved through business. It had its virtues. Who can be entirely against pragmatic optimization? But it also had its dark side and dehumanizing extremes. Management by objectives, matrix management, Scrum, OKRs, data-driven decision-making, the open plan office, each of these has their clear benefits. But each has also been adopted rapidly across companies, across entire industries, not because we had done careful weighing of benefits and trade-offs, but because a given concept was the new hotness. What's the mechanism driving the proliferation of these trends? The history covered in this podcast points most strongly to the role of influencers, most often in the form of companies, driving the story forward. In turn, IBM, DEC, Intel, and Google have been the star influencers of the technology industry. The tendency to chase Google in the post-2000 software industry is especially striking. Often, of course, companies follow Google because it really does have incredible technology, and by virtue of its scale, is among the first to face new challenges. But the halo effect of very real success in some areas can cause companies to assume everything a leader like Google does is unambiguously correct. Following Google's lead with scaling technologies like MapReduce and Bigtable has a much tighter logical connection than following its use of laddered OKRs or open bullpen offices. It stands to reason that in the near future, the methods used by new leading companies like OpenAI will gain increasing attention. The company's success is already driving fast followers to mimic its technological approaches, but if history is any guide, we can expect plenty of attention to be paid to how the company organizes and motivates its workers, how it sets its strategy, how it measures progress, and so on. Some of this attention will be entirely appropriate. Some will be a halo effect at play. For working software people and executives, the reason to acknowledge our tendency to go for fads is that it encourages us to be deliberate about how we work and to be less afraid of breaking with convention. There is value to understanding what others do and what packaged methodologies exist in the marketplace, but they're not obviously correct just because they're being used elsewhere. A variety of methods have always been possible so far, and we should make active rather than passive choices about how we want to work. Alright, so those observations were 1. Continuous exponential growth in capabilities has been critical to both the dynamism and the fun of software. 2. Neither technology nor market structure enforce a single way to make software. 3. How we work is driven largely by ideas and values. And 4. Our business is prone to fads. Now, what does the past, and what do these observations, tell us about what will come next? As I've worked on this season through the middle of 2023, two great upheavals have been roiling the software business. The first has been the large-scale tech layoffs of 2022 and 23, which, as of this recording, have cost some 400,000 tech workers in the US and linked countries their jobs. As part of this phenomenon, firms have reorganized teams and roles, with functions like product management and QA removed, reduced, or recast. The second is the recent acceleration of artificial intelligence, with large language models increasingly able to take on complex language tasks, like preparing documents and writing code. What does the history of the software industry tell us to expect from these changes? On its own, the wave of tech layoffs is distressing, but probably passing. In percentage terms, the financial and employment consequences of the dot-com crash in 2000 were much more severe than what we've seen in the post-pandemic period. We discussed why tech firms and venture capital are so sensitive to interest rates in Episode 7, and the current layoffs were driven largely by the recent rise in American and European central bank rates. I certainly won't hazard a guess about when or if those rates will drop, but the industry will adjust. In the dot-com crash, the ideas of the first-mover advantage and if you build it, they will come were found wanting. And as a result, the 2000s gave us the concepts of customer development, product market fit, the MVP, and the company as a learning machine. In 2023, the current wave seems much less disruptive. As I record this, the NASDAQ index is only about 9% below its late 2021 high. The tech giants and popular consumer tech firms, with the possible sui generis exception of Twitter, all seem to have survived the storm. With a much lower magnitude of disruption, the magnitude of resulting change will also likely be lower. That said, a prolonged period of high interest rates will have lasting impact. We can expect that venture capital will be much harder to raise for the next few years, so while some unemployed techies will start new companies, they will likely have a much greater focus on near-term profitability than the firms of the 2000s startup wave. Existing firms will shift focus towards profitability, cutting investments in long-term speculative projects. Skunkworks are likely going to be out of fashion for a while. Companies will experiment with removing or greatly reducing roles where they can. Workers in product management, project management, QA, and other engineering-adjacent functions will likely find themselves stretched across more engineers. Engineers may be expected to pick up more job responsibilities to compensate. This relative scarcity can drive fruitful new innovations in how we work. If my claims are correct, that markets are not deterministic of methodology, and ideas do drive how we work, then we may be entering a time of fresh experimentation as firms organize themselves more purely around profitability and capital efficiency. I don't know what those resulting innovations will be, but it will be interesting to see. Speaking of unknowns, I suppose I need to address the AI elephant. The world's best minds are nowhere near consensus on what to expect, so I certainly won't pretend much certainty about what comes next. But if we look at current technologies and imagine forward one iteration, generative AI primarily seems like a force multiplier and productivity booster, allowing individual developers and small teams to do more. It seems likely that companies with large existing code bases will adopt these technologies for incremental gains, making their existing developers more productive thanks to code autocomplete tools, improved debugging, and other co-pilot functions. But for the near term, existing companies will likely have such complicated existing code bases that they will rely heavily on their existing human engineers, because the humans can see the big picture and ensure that the new pieces fit together with the existing systems. At this point, AIs still struggle to handle that much context. Thus, I expect existing companies will benefit from productivity gains, but that their core team structures and work patterns will be resilient for some time to come. People will still write spec docs in basically the same way that we have since waterfalling in the 1960s, will hold the same scrum meetings and sprints that we've had since the 1990s, and will optimize for OKRs as we have since the 2000s. More interesting to me is how firms that are, for lack of a better term, AI native will work. As AIs transition from solving narrow problems to larger problems, instructions like create a messaging app will become more and more feasible. At least at first, the code may have redundancies and dead ends. It may not run as efficiently as it might. But the history of software shows us that abstractions can be incredibly valuable productivity boosters, as ever stronger technical foundations make the inefficiencies relatively unimportant. I decided not to cover Clayton Christensen's 1997 book, The Innovator's Dilemma, in this season, though if there's a season 2 of this podcast, that book will almost certainly get proper coverage. For now, I'll just give a lightning summary, which is that new technologies become disruptive to existing incumbents and spawn new high-growth technologies when they offer a way to deliver a radically cheaper product to customers, even if it's inferior to the dominant company's products in most ways. A new disruptive growth company's product just needs to be good enough in most ways, and then better in one critical way. In Christensen's world, that axis of advantage is almost always cheaper price. AI-native software companies that find ways to build good enough software at a fraction of the price of incumbent companies with large, expensive software engineering organizations could be a major disruptor to the software industry, fundamentally changing how we work. AI may not be ready to work at the frontier of what's just barely possible for some time, but it doesn't need to be. All it needs is to be good enough for a low-end slice of the market, large enough to keep some small companies alive and innovating. It seems very likely that current AIs, or the next generation, will satisfy this criteria. Of course, speculating about the future of AI is incredibly fraught. In 20 years, maybe we're all living in an AI-powered utopia, or an AI-powered dystopia, or we're all nanobot food. Or maybe this was all much ado about a marginal technology that peters out quickly. It's impossible to say, and I'm very aware that just 2 or 3 years ago, some smart, if idealistic people were calling the crypto-fueled distributed autonomous organization the future of everything. Predictions are dangerous, especially about the future. Here be dragons. So with all this, what's a practitioner to do? Way back in episode 0 of this series, I said it was not going to be about how to be a PM or how to be an engineer, and I wouldn't tell you how to run sprints or anything like that. So I won't, in part because that sounds both boring and presumptive of me to do, and in part because there is no right answer. And that's the big takeaway. We are all improvising. No one ever said, "Here's waterfall and I think it's good." Winston Royce never used the term, and while he did think he knew some good practices, he was an incrementalist by later in his career. The Agile Manifesto, for all its fame, is just 68 words about general values. It's not a prescription for a single way to work. After the manifesto, we had a roughly 5-year Cambrian explosion of books about how to agile, followed a decade later by another explosion of packages for how to agile at scale. So we're all winging it in a sea of ideas, some good, some terrible, and plenty in between. As a practitioner, do what makes sense. Try out new technologies, because a few times each decade, something comes along that makes a lasting impact. Drop stuff that doesn't make any sense, because most of our ideas entered the canon when computers were orders of magnitude weaker than they are today. Many of our ideas predate the consumer internet and even the personal computer. The muddy agile consensus is a lazy compromise. The consensus preserves very old ideas about wise central planners and bureaucratic elites that don't stand up to serious scrutiny. The consensus lets individual contributors off the hook of actually engaging with their customers. The consensus lets managers optimize for their chosen measuring sticks rather than solving user problems. It creates incentives for teams to haggle over their meeting schedules rather than worrying about deliverables. And it's fine, I guess. Lots of big successful businesses were built on the back of the muddy agile consensus. It's the common bag of shared null hypotheses that let us communicate with one another without reinventing the wheel and haggling over every point of process. But some null hypotheses were made to be rejected, at least in some settings. So my hope is that this series gave you the context to critically examine how you work, to see where ideas and practices came from, and to understand the problems they were meant to solve or the benefits they were meant to create. I hope you now feel a bit better equipped to double down on the good stuff and to challenge the things that aren't working. They're not preordained. Maybe you can do better. And with that, I'm going to close the first season of Product Fundamentals. I want to thank you for listening, and I want to doubly thank those of you who have reached out with questions, corrections, and feedback. This has been a passion project that I've wanted to take action on for a long time, and I appreciate you listening along. I'm not sure if or when there will be a proper second season. I'd certainly like there to be. There are a lot more interesting things to learn about, but this project was a solid part-time job for the last 4 months. I need to take a break and clear some real-life backlog before I can swing back around to this. That said, I hope you'll stay subscribed to this feed, as I expect to post some one-offs here in the near future, including a presentation I gave on the history of product management to the Tokyo PM community. And I've got a handful of other ideas kicking around too. So, until next time, thank you again for bearing with me and listening in. I've enjoyed learning and sharing this material, and I hope you found something valuable for you in it too. As always, your comments and feedback on this episode are very welcome. You can find a transcript, links to sources, and ways to reach me on the show website at prodfund.com. And if you enjoyed this season and you want to hear more, do me a favor, share it with someone you think would enjoy it too. Those download numbers really are a powerful motivator. Thank you very much for listening.